Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Anselm Rink, an assistant professor of political economy at the Graduate School of Decision Sciences in Konstanz, Germany, and also affiliated with the Social Science Center Berlin. He earned his PhD in 2017 at Columbia University with a dissertation entitled Essays on Inequality and Social Cohesion, and he also holds a bachelor's degree from the London School of Economics. Professor Rink has a wide range of interests, including the political economy of development, European politics, migration, and public opinion. Methodologically, he uses field experiments and network analysis in his work, and also claims to enjoy Bayesian statistics and machine learning. I guess somebody has to love Bayesian statistics. If it's not going to be me, it might as well be him. Although young in his professional career, Anselm has published several articles in notable places such as the American Journal of Political Science, the Journal of Conflict Resolution, and Comparative Political Studies, all top journals in the field. The article that he penned for the last journal mentioned is Do Protestant Missionaries Undermine Political Authority? Evidence from Peru. And that will be the primary topic of today's discussion, although we may reserve some time for his work on religious radicalization at the end of the show. Now, none of this scholarship comes cheap, and so Professor Rink's research has received financial support from the U.S. Department of State, the Brookings Institution, the International Youth Foundation, and the Center for the Study of Development Strategies. We will link to his website on our website, so stop by and visit us as we enjoy the company. Anselm, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
So this Bayesian statistics stuff, you love them. Most people, well, they're really into curling now with the Winter Olympics going on. But, okay, Bayesian statistics. You got to justify this. And also that thing on machine learning. You're not in the process of melding your brain with a computer now, are you?
Yes, I do. I mean, I have other hobbies, too. So the idea of Bayesian statistics, essentially, is to systematically use our prior information, right? So we all sort of have a gut feeling about certain things. We don't have prior research on a topic. And so Bayesian statistics allows us to, in a more structured way, incorporate that information into our empirical models. So that's why I love it. I think it's not done enough, but it's getting better. So that's that. And the machine learning, well, I guess that's sort of the new stuff around the block. It's not dramatically different from what we've done so far in the social sciences. But in some instances, especially if you have a lot of data, it can help quite a bit in sort of structuring it and letting the data speak in a way. So that's why I love the two. Even though they're not, your average hobby.
Yeah, no, it's not like sitting around doing Sudoku or something like that. And as an old guy here that grew up on the 1970s dystopian science fiction films, I just want to tell you that all this machine learning on big data and stuff, that's how the Terminator started, right? So just be careful with that, because if I'm going to get run over by the robopocalypse, I'm going to come looking for you, so... I think you started it, but no. In all seriousness, though, you have actually a very, very interesting portfolio, having written on religion in Peru, religious radicalization in Kenya, and also bureaucratic discrimination in German welfare policy. So you're all over the place, which is kind of the scholars that I love. How did you end up studying all those things that you study?
Right, it's a good question. I mean, so far I've just followed my nose, essentially. And if there's a topic that I'm interested in, I'll research it, I'll read some historical literature, some prior papers, and then see if there's sort of a niche that I could work on. The Peru study came about, I think, because I essentially was a Peace Corps or German Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador, and that's how I got interested in the work of missionaries. And then Kenya came about through my co-author, Kunal Sharma, who's now at ETH Zurich, who's been very interested in that topic, and it was sort of a natural fit to work together. And the work on Germany, I guess that's because I'm German, so that would explain that.
So very fortuitous. You were in the Peace Corps in Ecuador. You must have run across a bunch of Protestant missionaries then, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So I lived with a very nice family outside of Quito, the capital, and roughly half an hour from Quito. And, you know, the presence of missionaries and a wide variety of churches was just very interesting. And the effects on the community were pretty obvious to me. And then years later in graduate school, that got me wondering, why is there so little research on it? And there really isn't all that much, especially in political science and also economics, which is the discipline that I studied in undergraduate. I saw these, very strong effects of missionaries on these communities, both positive and sort of more negative. And that's why I embarked on that project in Peru. And the reason, Ecuador isn't Peru, it's quite far actually from Ecuador to Peru. The reason why I ended up in southern Peru was, again, by chance. I talked to a lot of people and to find an appropriate study site. And it was a lady from France who alerted me to that specific region and to the sort of historical case that I explore. And that's how I ended up in Peru.
So when you were at Columbia University, too, one of the famous scholars that they have there who does a lot of Latin American politics and has had his eye on religion recently is Al Stepin. Did you have a chance to work with him at all?
Yeah, so I took his class on religion and politics. Very impressive class. One of the most widely read scholars. There's been a little doubt who, sadly enough, recently passed away. And he knew the paper. He very much liked the case. He asked me tough questions. We discussed it in the class as well once I had collected the data. And so that certainly shaped that research agenda. And he's a great scholar of religion and politics, which is, a small field. So it's very nice to study with him and learn from Al Stepin.
Yeah, he's written a lot of great stuff, too, in the past. And it is sad that he has passed away. But let's turn now to your research on Protestant in Peru, and as I mentioned, it was recently published in Comparative Political Studies, and I have to confess that the reason this article caught my eye is that it cites four different pieces that I've written, which is very cool. It popped up on my Google Scholar alert, and so let that be a lesson to some of you listeners. If you want to be on the show, you have to cite me a lot. That's all I'm asking. Not really. Actually, it makes sense because you are discussing Protestantism in Latin America, which was one of my old bailiwicks. So let's go ahead and start with the broad question that you're asking in this paper, which is, do religious organizations undermine political authority? Why is that a central question? Why would I expect political religious organizations to have anything to do with political authority in the first place?
Right. I mean, I think it's one of the biggest questions, right? So even going back to St. Augustine or, the really old scholars of the field, it's always been, a battle between the secular and the non-secular city, the religious city. And so I think that's what this paper is sort of trying to grapple with, admittedly in a very small context, in a very specific context. But I think the big question is hopefully somewhat obvious, though the case certainly is very new and different. And the reason why I was interested in that topic in particular is it was the first thing that really caught my eye while I was in Peru. So the original idea, and that's another paper that I've written on this case, was to look at the effect of Protestant missionaries on social capital, on community cohesion. And that's, that makes sense and all. But then when I attended the sermon, talked to missionaries, talked to believers, talked to non-believers, I realized that there seemed to be a tension between the political authority within the villages and the sort of religious authority that the missionaries and local ministers had. So that's really what I was trying to get after. There hasn't been a lot written on that, which is good because it got me into a great journal. But it also meant I was really on my own. The theorizing was really, I had to rely on my own, and that made it a little more difficult. So it wasn't a sort of well-trodden literature that I could draw on, besides your work.
Yeah, that's actually a good lesson for graduate students. I know we often want to push our graduate students to do the same thing that we're doing or to do a topic that is hot in the field right now because there's a lot of stuff on it. But you know, occasionally you really find a question that nobody has addressed and it really opens up a lot of doors. I've benefited from that in my career and I think other graduate students could as well. So it's a scary path, but it's a well rewarding path if you do it correctly, and I think you have. Tell us what we need to know about authority, political authority. It seems fairly obvious that, you got the mayor in the town and he passes a law that says don't go more than 45 kilometers per hour on this road and then you obey. And so that's political authority. But what do you, or how do you understand political authority in your study?
Right. It's actually sort of, in a way, it's easy to define it, following our gut feeling, someone has authority or power. But once you go into the literature on authority, there's a lot of different definitions. And in situations like that, it's sort of tough who to follow. And so what I decided to do, maybe also to sell the piece a little bit more, is to go back to Max Weber, who's worked on not just religion and capitalism and so on, but also actually on authority. And he sort of really looks at two predominant important mechanisms through which people gain authority. And one is sort of this obedience mechanism. So someone obeys an authority figure or has to obey. And the other is the persuasion mechanism. So you really don't have authority if you can't intellectually persuade people. And I like these two aspects of his definition because that really seemed to resonate quite well with what I was observing in Peru. So there's the obedience mechanism, you follow something, and then there's the persuasion mechanism in the sense that you are being persuaded by the authority figure. And both mechanisms seem to be affected by missionaries. That was my gut feeling, and that's what also turned out to reveal itself in the data.
Now, a lot of people, when they talk about political authority, tend to focus on that first one, obedience, more so than persuasion, and that leads a lot of people to focus on what we call in the field structural or institutional theories of obedience. But you're taking a more psychological approach at the cognitive level. And does this connect with the persuasion aspect of it a little bit more? And why did you go down that pathway?
Right. So I think there's a couple of answers to that. So my interest in political psychology was sparked by one of my doctoral advisors, Don Green, who's worked a lot on political psychology. So that was certainly inspired on that front. The other reason was that there has already been a lot of really good work on sort of more structural determinants. Robert Woodbury, you yourself, and others have really worked on these kinds of phenomena. So the psychological aspects seem to be less studied. And it also made just intuitive sense because religion also, has psychological consequences. And I think that's why I wanted to sort of take this approach, which sort of looks at two phenomena, obedience and persuasion, which have been discussed quite a bit in psychology. So yeah, the paper does a lot of, draws a lot of things together, hopefully somewhat convincingly, but it also means that you're really open to a lot of criticism from many different angles.
Yeah, that's always true in academics and that the like. I'm not a psychology kind of guy, but I do appreciate the work that you're doing because it does fill in gaps. People look at me and they say, oh, you do the institutional or rational choice kind of approach. You're ignoring everything else. And I said, yeah, because I only got 24 hours a day. I'm going to leave something else for other folks to study, and that's what you're doing. So your general question breaks down along the lines of these two dimensions of authority, which is obedience and persuasion. To what extent does Protestantism promote obedience and persuadability? Because Martin Luther, he was very disobedient, if you ask the Pope about him.
Yeah. Well, again, Protestants, at least historically speaking, were both obedient and disobedient. There's this great quote of Luther, which I don't know in English, but it essentially means you have to be obedient to everyone and you should be obedient to no one. And so there certainly is, obedience matters, that is to say. And so in this case, I have sort of two arguments why obedience should be affected. The first one is more theological argument in the sense that if people newly adopt this belief, they are accustomed to this idea of having an authority figure, that is God, you know, in the sort of more abstract sense, and also a priest or minister at the local level. So there's this sort of social, there's this theological getting used to this idea of an authority figure. The other is a sort of more habitual mechanism in the sense that people then go to church, they attend services quite regularly and for long hours, because I attended many, many, many. And that sort of habitually accustoms them to that idea of someone telling them what to do and what to believe and so on. Now, admittedly, you know, this shouldn't be viewed in the sort of, you know, mechanistic way. People didn't just blindly obey, right? So this is very important. There is the persuasion aspect certainly is important. But, you know, the first two, sort of this habitual and this more theological mechanism did play out when I was in the community, and it was quite interesting to observe.
Now, you, in your article, cite this very famous study back in, I think it was the 1950s, maybe early 60s, the Milgram study, where they put people in a room and gave them shockers, and they were told, you know, shock these people in this other room, and they obeyed. So how are you using that in there? How does that affect obedience? People just listen to people telling them to shock other people in other rooms?
Right, so it's not that dramatic. So the Milgram study, you know, it certainly pioneers the field and it's very famous, but it's also, you know, a dramatic study, certainly unethical, and part of the reason why we now have, you know, institutional review of the research that we plan to conduct. So it's not something quite as radical. In my study, and that was really one of the challenges, to find a measure of obedience that could be implemented in the field, right? So you can't ask people, you know, to what extent do you obey X, Y, and Z, but I also wanted a behavioral measure. And so what I did, I sort of, you know, thought back and forth, and I included this sort of priming experiment, if you will, and I told respondents in the survey at a random point during the survey, authority X, Y, and I randomized that, wants us to conduct this study in a different place. Do you think we should follow this instruction? And then the enumerators, and I did many of the surveys myself, recorded whether people wanted to obey this request, this hypothetical request from that authority figure. So that was sort of a nice way of measuring it in the field without using, you know, Milgram's very harsh technique of electroshocks and so on, which certainly, you know, could not be done in this day and age, and shouldn't be done.
Yeah. Thanks, Milgram, for making the internal review board, or what they call human subjects division in the past, all the more difficult to get through. It's like one of the worst parts of the research process. But again, very necessary. What about persuadability? So obedience can be conditioned, but what about persuadability? How do we condition that, or how can we figure out what's going on there?
Right. So the theoretical argument in the paper that I'm trying to do sort of has two elements to it. And I argue that there is an intellectual substitution effect in the sense that these new converts now think about different topics. So essentially there's a substitution from more secular topics to more theological topics. People read the Bible, people study the Bible, and, you know, the road that needs to be built may not be quite as important as, you know, being engaged in the scripture. So that's the one sub-mechanism, if you will, there. The other is sort of, I call it cognitive dissonance, even though that term is a little problematic, in the sense that what is being taught in the churches, in the sermons that I listen to, is sometimes at odds with what is preached by political authorities, communicated, I should say. So those are the two ways in which I argue that missionaries actually reduce persuadability. So, and that makes it a little complicated, makes the story not quite as clean, because what I, in essence, argue and then confirm with the data is that missionaries increase obedience but decrease persuadability or persuasion, right? And that is to say their effect on political authority is mixed. And that may explain why this debate's been going on for 2,000 years.
Yeah, that is a really interesting insight and one of the important and interesting findings of the paper, that these two things, obedience and persuadability or persuasion, work in different directions with one another. And we'll talk about that when we get to the findings. You focus on Protestant missionaries, and Protestant missionaries, to some extent, are unique addition to Peru's historical culture, at least since the Spanish colonial days, largely a Catholic nation. They come in the 20th century, stir things up a little bit. But here's the question I had reading your paper. Could this stuff that you're doing apply to Catholics as well?
Right. So that's a good question. Also a question that I got from the reviewers and the editor. The short or the true answer is I don't know, because I have not observed and I haven't studied it. The longer answer is that my hunch would be probably not, because what I observe in my paper is that these effects, this increase in obedience and reduction in persuadability, they are stronger for within missionary groups that are more strict, so Pentecostal groups, as compared to, say, Adventists, who are a little more mainline, if you will. So that is to say, there seems to be something theological going on. It's not just that any religious group or any other group, soccer club or whatever, could have these effects. There seems to be something that is, a result of the actual teaching that's going on. And so while I don't know what the Catholics, what would happen if we were to sort of compare Catholics to non-Catholics, my hunch is that the effects would not be as strong.
Full disclosure here, I was not one of the reviewers of your article. So just in case people are saying, Gil said that because he must have been reviewing the article and that. No, I was not. I don't review that many articles. So interesting that other reviewers noted that too. But for all you other graduate students or scholars out there looking for a project, you can take Professor Rink's research and then apply it to Catholicism, which I think would be a very cool paper as well. Now, we see this with religious groups. You say this probably wouldn't be a big of a deal with a soccer club or anything, but what about other groups or political parties or political movements, one that has been active in Peru in the 1960s, 70s through the, I guess, early 90s, was Sendero Luminoso. Is there any inherent difference between a religion and a kind of a revolutionary vanguard party like this?
Right. It's a good question, and something that I've been wondering myself. It's hard to study that empirically, right?
Yeah.
Well, part of the reason in my paper, what I try to argue is that the communities that I study, because of, essentially disorganization as a result of the Civil War, were sort of exogenously exposed to the missionaries. But differently, there were sort of, these communities were off limits in the 70s because the Sendero Luminoso, the rebel group, was quite active. And then in the 80s, they rushed into these communities and treated them as if random. It's certainly not purely random, but I do a lot of sort of statistical tests to show that these communities are quite comparable. That is to say, communities that did not receive missionaries are comparable to those that did. Now, adding, another political party to this, or a soccer club or something else, would be perfect, but it's just not how history played out there. My hunch, again, and I have to speculate here, is that there's something very unique about missionaries. The communities are very tightly knit, very regularized interaction. People really believe in the cause, and there's also this otherworldly dimension which political parties typically don't have. So they're different, but there also is an overlap. So I would be very, welcome, in addition to the study on Catholic missionaries, to read another study on the effect of political parties on obedience and persuasion, if someone wants to do a study like that.
Yeah, make sure you contact them if you got some data or some ideas for doing that. It is neat that you did this study, because the Protestant missions kind of act as an exogenous force after Sendero Luminoso pulls out of these areas. They capture Guzman, and it's kind of game over for them. So you have a really ideal research design set up here. Explain what this research design was. Kind of walk us through the steps of how you're going to test whether or not Protestant missionaries affect obedience and affect persuasion.
Right. So typically what one would do is compare communities that are Protestant to those that are not, and see if there's a difference. Now, the issue there is what, social scientists call endogeneity or selection. It could be the case that the Protestant communities were different to begin with. Perhaps the Protestant communities, or those that were chosen by Protestant missionaries, were more obedient and less persuadable to begin with. And then the difference is not due to the missionaries, but due to some other characteristic. While I find that quite hard to believe, it could be the case, right? So who knows? The way to check for that is to look at many, many other variables before the missionaries came and see whether they were similar across the treated groups, the communities that were visited by missionaries and those that were not. Now, that's hard to do because you need historic data. And fortunately, in my case, I got access to the Peruvian census. And that allowed me to show that the communities that received missionaries and those that didn't were very, very similar. And I also draw on sort of historical analysis to show that there really wasn't a clear selection pattern. So it wasn't the case that the missionaries really selected one community and not the other. I talked to a lot of the missionaries. You know, it could still be the case, who knows, but I'm pretty certain at this point that it was as if allocated by chance. And I think part of the reason is that, you know, missionaries are all-encompassing. They want to, you know, convert everyone, ideally. So there isn't all that much discrimination, if you will. Now, having said that, I only look at 16 villages in, you know, one specific area of Peru. So that really must be underlined that, you know, these sort of external validity, as we call it, whether this generalizes to the entire world is very questionable. So I can really only speak of these specific villages that I studied.
In terms of the Protestants that were down there, who are we talking about? I think you mentioned the Adventists down there. Are there Presbyterians? Are there Mormons? What did the mix of missionaries look like?
Right. So as I'm sure you know, it's very complicated. There are many, many groups. And, you know, every day you find a new church and a new mission, and that's part of the fun. Looking at missionaries, that there's just so many, and they're all somewhat similar, but all have their sort of unique selling point. In the area that I studied, there were three major missions. One is Seventh-day Adventists, and then there's two sort of local, more Pentecostal churches. One is called Maranatha, and the other is called Peruana. Then there were some more. There were Baptists. I didn't come across, well, I actually came across three Mormons, I think, in my sample, I think they just recently had set up a small shop, but nothing sort of major. So those are the major actors. But as soon as you go, you know, as soon as you go to other villages that were not part of the sample, you will find new stuff, new missions from all over the world. So it's really very very diverse.
One of the things I liked about your research, and this is different than a lot of political science that's being done now where you just download a big data set, is that you went down to the field, you spent time down there, and you mentioned earlier in our discussion that you actually attended some of these churches. What was that experience like? Do you have any good stories about going into the Peruana Pentecostal church down the road and just, you know, handling snakes or something, you know, that really shocked you?
Right. So I think it's, you know, going to the field is quintessential. Even though it takes time, it's, you know, it's rough, it costs money, and it's also, you know, sometimes a little bit awkward because you have to introduce yourself and everyone, you know, is a little skeptical. What is this, you know, tall German dude doing? But it actually worked out very, very nicely. People were extremely friendly, very welcoming, and I learned a tremendous amount. The one thing I have to say is that I do speak Spanish, but I don't speak Quechua, the local language that most people actually speak in these communities. So they started off the sermons in Spanish, which would help me get along, and then they would, you know, quickly move over to Quechua and then talk in Quechua for the next 4 to 5 hours. Now, I, you know, didn't want to get up and leave and be rude, so I just had to sit there and essentially listen to a four-hour Quechua sermon, not understanding a single word. So that got me, you know, thinking about a lot of things, including research design. So it was productive. But yeah, overall it was, you know, a great experience.
You just said, if I heard you correctly, that these services are 4 to 5 hours. Now, here in the United States, if the pastor gets to about 50 minutes, people start to get really antsy in the pews. What was it like being in a 4 hour, 5 hour service? Was there beverages and food service? Did you have bathroom breaks? I mean, that must have been pretty amazing.
Right. So it was very amazing to see. And some people went outside and would come back in, and some kids would run out and would run in. But overall, people, you know, were quite committed. And actually, many of them stayed for the full time. I mean, I didn't actually time it, but it must have been that long because some of my recordings and so on were very long. And so I think, yeah, overall, some people, such as myself, sometimes would go outside, you know, catch some fresh air. But many people just stayed inside and listened and sang and did many, many different things that are part of these services.
The music must have been great, because I'm a big fan of Incan music or Andean music. I love all that kind of thing. And then also, I know the Pentecostals are just absolutely fantastic at revving up their services with music. So was the music pretty cool?
Yeah, so it was. So I'm a big music fan as well. So it was very interesting to see what kind of music they would sing. There was some sort of more European style music. I think that would also, you know, some of it was provided by these sort of bigger churches and then just, you know, put on CD and played out loud. But a lot of, you know, traditional local music as well, sort of, and then all that merged together. So there is, you know, it's very, very fascinating mix of styles that I appreciated quite a bit.
Yeah, definitely a fun thing to do. The next thing that you did, other than just attending these services to see what's going on, get a feel for the lay of the land, is that you went out and you talked to religious missionaries. What were you talking to them about? And one of the other questions I had, too, is to what extent are these missionaries from abroad, say the United States or Europe or somewhere, and to what extent are they Latin American to begin with? They come from another area of Peru or maybe from a different country.
Right. So there's both, right? There are some missionaries that are from abroad. So I specifically remember two American missionaries, and then also quite a few from Peru. And the term missionary itself is, you know, somewhat, you know, people call themselves missionaries, but then some, I guess I wouldn't traditionally label a missionary. So for example, a minister that, you know, travels from some, you know, across some villages may not be traditionally perceived as a missionary. I typically think of missionaries as those coming from abroad. But, you know, if you take sort of the more Christian way of, you know, the term mission, that would really just mean missionizing anywhere, and you don't necessarily have to come from abroad. The ones from abroad were in both cases Americans, and, you know, very easy to get along with, very happy to talk about their experience, tremendous local knowledge because they had been there for, you know, over 20 years. And my primary goal was to, you know, get a sense of the overall situation, just making sense of the different churches, the history of the place. And the second sense was to get an understanding of the quote-unquote selection. That is to say, whether missionaries really had a clear strategy of selecting communities or whether that was a little more haphazard, as I then end up claiming in the paper. And so that's why I talked to them, and it was, you know, it was a great experience and great opportunity to really understand the local context.
Now, how easy was it to get interviews with them? You said they were pretty easy to talk to, but did they start to ask you, well, why? You're a social scientist from out there in New York City, and I'm kind of curious why you're asking these questions. And the other question, too, is are you asking them directly to the extent of, are you trying to make these people more obedient? Are you trying to persuade them against the, you know, political leaders in their village? What are you doing with these interviews?
Right. So overall, in the fieldwork that I've done, I've always experienced people to be extremely open, very happy to chat. And I would always be, you know, very transparent about my research. I would tell them what, you know, my hypotheses perhaps were. And, you know, I think people appreciate that. And they understand, you know, what social science research is, really just trying to figure out what's really happening, essentially. On the sort of more, I guess, delicate questions, you know, this takes some time. I wouldn't, you know, start off an interview asking, you know, do you try to make people obedient? I would ask that at a later stage and maybe in a more polite manner. But that specific question on obedience and persuasion, you know, I wouldn't really count on what the missionaries tell me there, just because there surely is what we call, you know, social desirability bias. It's certainly the case that they would, you know, answer these questions perhaps in such a way that it's not perfectly representative of what's actually happening. So I didn't really ask those questions in any systematic way.
So what's the general findings that you get out from qualitatively talking to these missionaries? What, if you had to summarize a few points of this is who these missionaries are, what would it be?
Right. So I think the main takeaway for me, just, you know, qualitatively speaking, is that missionaries matter. These missions matter. It's, in the social sciences, we sometimes tend to think that, oh, you know, this religion stuff, that's, you know, it's unscientific and it must not matter all that much, because many academics too, you know, are not strong believers. And I think then they may think it's unlikely that it has these strong effects. But if you talk to missionaries, you begin to understand, you know, they have a zeal, they really want to convert, they are invested in the communities, they are there for a long time, they have good funding and so on. So there's, you know, many, many reasons that explain why we deserve strong effects as a result of missionary activity.
The next thing you did was you administered a larger survey to villagers. So these are people who are attending these churches, and I would assume people who are not attending these churches as well. What were you asking in these surveys, and what was the response rate that you got? Were people willing to say, oh yeah, tall German guy's in here asking us questions, no problem, I'll do that?
Right. Yeah, so I think overall my response rate, you know, I started off doing the interviews myself, and then I trained at some point because it got a lot of work. I trained master's students from the university in Cusco. And I started off myself just to, you know, see whether the questions work and just to get a sense of the community. And my response rate was quite high. And the enumerators also had a high response rate. You know, people think it's interesting that someone comes and asks some questions. Many would say, oh, are you from the census? And then we would say, no, we're actually not. We're from the university. But they were eager to tell their stories. Of course, some people dropped out and some people didn't want to participate, but that was rather low, in, you know, less than 10%. The questions that we asked were ranged. They were quite long, so it started off with just general demographics. How old are you? You know, what's your income? What's your primary occupation? These sort of standard questions that one tends to ask in these kinds of surveys. And then we started talking about social capital, as I had mentioned before, because that was originally one part of the project and still is. And then we also asked some questions on obedience and persuasion and beliefs. So it was quite a long list of questions, not too many, because then people get tired and they want to move on. So it was a mix. And we also added some what we call lab in the field experiments, like behavioral outcomes. And those serve the purpose of ensuring that people don't just say what they think the researcher wants to hear, but sort of observing behavior in a more unobtrusive manner.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit more, because that's the really interesting part about this. How did you set this quote-unquote field experiment up?
Right. So what we did is to think of behavioral measures that could measure both persuasion and obedience. The obedience measure I had already touched upon before was to, at a random point during the survey, say, look, authorities have told us that we are actually supposed to conduct this survey in a public place. We're fine either way. Would you like us to move? And then we recorded whether people wanted to move or not. And the idea here was that, you know, if they are very obedient to authority figures, plausibly they say yes, and then the interview was relocated. And that served really to have a measure of obedience that's a little more robust and a bit more behavioral. Now, I haven't seen this measure implemented in the past, so I can't really say comment on how reliable it is, but it was a new measure, and there aren't all that many measures for obedience. And I like these measures because they also, you know, lighten the tension a little bit. They break the flow of the survey in a way, so that's quite nice. Another measure we did, for example, is what's known as a random allocation game. It works as such. You give people coins, actually in this case 10 coins, I believe it was, and then you have them throw a die. And whenever they get a 1, 2, and 3, they're supposed to put money into one envelope. And whenever they get 4, 5, and 6, they're supposed to put money in another envelope. Now, one envelope remains with the person. The other envelope goes to some other cause. Now, people that don't cheat should, in statistical expectation, have five coins, in one envelope and five in the other, right? Because by chance, or, you know, just using basic statistics, you should have five there and five in the other. But if you are a cheater, then you may put more money into your own envelope or more money into the other envelope. And that's sort of a really neat game to measure this kind of cheating behavior. And we also did that in the field and analyzed that in another paper that looks at effects on individualism and social capital.
So were these coins, you know, significant in value, or is this just, you know, one of the problems we have in survey methodology often and experiments, cheap talk? Right. Was the money amount fairly significant?
It was actually quite significant. These are very poor communities, mostly subsistence farming with very low incomes. So it mattered. It was, you know, if I had to sort of convert it on the fly, it would be something like gaining maybe $30 to $50, something along those lines, in U.S. terms for a U.S. citizen. So it's not, you know, it's not millions, but it's also not, you know, a dime.
Then the last question on the application of the field experiment and the surveys is about how long did it take? Was this a half hour, an hour, 2 hours? Was it a four-hour sermon? How long did it take?
Right. So the surveys usually, I have some data on this, usually took... Well, we started off, it took us much longer, about an hour. And then after a while, after you get to, you know, the 800th respondent, you're down to roughly 30 minutes or sometimes 25. So it was a nice mix, you know, much longer than you really take up too much time with the respondents. If it's too short, you know, you might as well ask some more questions. So I think we struck a good balance there.
And so you said you had a sample size of about 800 or so?
Our sample size, I think our final sample size was 1,024. Just shy of a little over 1,000.
Yeah, that's a great sample size, especially for a field experiment. It can get pretty exhausting doing all those things. So, good one for you. Okay, so let's get to the payoff here. The general discussion of the results. What do you find?
Yeah, so we broadly find our hypotheses confirmed, and this. Part of the reason is that, you know, we had these hypotheses beforehand, but we, you know, sometimes as a researcher, it's always, you know, the big question is always, you know, chicken and egg. Do you start off with the hypothesis and then you go into the field, or do you go into the field and then come up with the hypotheses? In this case, it was sort of a mix of both. We had these hypotheses, but not in a very structured way, and then we, you know, laid them out much clearly in the final written paper. What we find is that we do see an increase in obedience and a slightly lower reduction in persuadability. So broadly in line with the theory. And importantly, it also, the effect sizes are stronger in communities that were exposed to more fervent, more stricter missionaries, as I had alluded to before.
So what does that mean, stricter missionaries? And would this be the Adventists? Would it be the Pentecostals? Who tended to be more strict?
So strict, maybe that's not the right word. It's, you know, it's hard to describe this phenomenon. I call it, you know, theological fervor in the paper, I believe. What we have in mind here, or what I have in mind, because it's actually single-authored, what I have in mind is really the how strong the belief is, how fundamentalist in a way, how Pentecostal others say. So we have a bunch of outcomes that we look for here. One is, you know, how long is the sermon? The sermons in these more fervent, stricter communities tend to be much longer. How literal is the interpretation of the Bible? To what extent do they participate in, these sort of divine healings and other forms that are, to my mind, an indicator of Pentecostalism? So there's quite a few things that are different in these communities. It's not just one thing, so it's sort of a, you know, phenomenon is a little broader and not quite as easy to grasp. But there certainly is this difference, and it matters quite a bit. But it's certainly also something that I feel like future research could really work on. And some people have worked on it. There's some very interesting evidence from Kenya on Pentecostalism, but I think more needs to be done, and that paper certainly is not very detailed on that aspect. As to which groups that refers to, we call the Adventists more mainline evangelical, and then the Peruana and the Maranatha group are more Pentecostal.
In terms of the implications for this, I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit. What would this mean for politics generally, either local politics or maybe even national politics? Many people are going to read your research and say, oh, yeah, it's increasing obedience, so these people are just going to become authoritarian stool pigeons, or, you know, it reduces persuadability, so these people are going to be better voters and they're going to be thinking more about this stuff. What do you think about that?
Right. It's a tough question because this is a very specific case, and it's, as I said before, it's tough to generalize in any meaningful way. I think it really just shows that the field of religion and politics is complicated, it's complex, and that study really just underlines that. It's not that they just make people more obedient in the sample that I study. It's also that they make them less persuadable, right? So it's sort of a, on the one hand, on the other hand. I think it shows that you would need a specific kind of politician to cater to these kinds of communities. And that is a politician that takes the, theological content of what people take interest in seriously. So I think that's perhaps one lesson, and I think we do see this quite broadly in Latin America and in other contexts, these politicians that specifically cater to evangelical voters.
Speaking of other contexts, I want to now turn to your research in Kenya. And you mentioned that it would be interesting to study Pentecostalism in Kenya. And it just so happens that you study religious radicalization with a co-author. Tell us a little bit about what is going on in terms of radicalization of Christians and Muslims in Kenya and how you got involved in this study to begin with.
Yeah, it's a very, it's a very different context, Sub-Saharan Africa, Kenya, Nairobi in particular. I got drawn into this topic by my co-author, Kunal Sharma, who really worked on radicalization and radical clerics for a long time, mostly with a focus on India, but also increasingly East Africa. I've done work, as you said in the beginning, on sort of the political economy of development more broadly in a variety of East African countries. And so it really was a nice way of combining my interest in development with my interest in religion. Now, this must have started off 4 years ago. We talked to many people on the ground, and we realized, Kenya is a thriving country. It's doing very well economically, but it also has this very severe problem of religious fundamentalism and radicalization. So there's a lot of violent attacks. I mean, not many, but a sizable number, and particularly in Nairobi and also at the coast. There are communities that are quite radicalized and have lots of religious tensions. And so we realized that the study of radicalization has so far mostly been qualitative, using interviews with people that are already radicalized, and very little work in a systematic sort of large N manner. And that's what we try to do in this study. And so what we do more specifically is that we collected a random sample of individuals in one neighborhood in Nairobi called Eastleigh, where we roughly have a share of 50-50 of Christian and Muslims and quite severe radicalization. And that allowed us to sample both radicalized individuals and non-radicalized individuals. And then we tested a variety of hypotheses that are typically put forth to explain radicalization. So something like economic marginalization, political exclusion, traumatic events, religiosity, and others, and test those hypotheses with our sample. And what we find, in short, is that it's not these macro-level things like economic or politics that seem to be correlated with radicalization, but rather meso- and micro-level things such as religiosity. So the study, in a way, showed that it is apparently also about religion. So religious radicalization is not just about, economics and politics. It seems to also be about religion.
Yeah.
It's been a fascinating research agenda. And recently we've launched some new projects in Nairobi that look at how to counter this radicalization. So hopefully more will come.
Yeah, who would have guessed that religion has to do a lot with religiosity? I mean, you know, it's one of these things that you discover and, you know, you look back and go, well, of course. But again, as you say, a lot of the work had been done on these big cross-country correlations with GDP per capita or, you know, poverty rates and different things like that. But yeah, this stuff all matters at the grassroots. And I think you've done a very, very fine job of bringing new methods to the field to examine and test this kind of stuff. Did you actually go do some of the field work in Kenya yourself?
Yeah, so I travel to Kenya quite frequently.
Oh, okay.
I'm actually going next Sunday again, partly for this project, partly for another project that I'm doing in South Sudan, actually, with missionaries again. So, missionaries are not leaving me alone, and I'm not leaving them alone. So what we're doing right now is we're implementing a project that's actually just concluded with the local NGO to see what kinds of messages are best suited to de-radicalize or to foster tolerance between Muslims and Christians. And so the data has just been collected, and I'm just going through it now. So I do go quite frequently, and it's much easier actually to do, you know, research in Nairobi as opposed to going to South Sudan or communities in Peru, just because it's, you know, it's just one flight from Europe or the U.S., and there's hotels and, you know, all the amenities that a researcher usually likes.
Yeah. That's definitely the case. It must be somewhat of a mind shift, though. You did a lot of your Peace Corps work in Latin America and then also working up in the highlands of Peru, and then all of a sudden you're in Kenya. Does that radical difference in perspectives or difference in world regions really kind of help you get a bigger grasp on the generalities and the comparisons that we like to make in political science?
I wish I could say yes. I think, honestly, it probably just, you know, shows me how complex and hard this stuff is, the social sciences in general. It's really made me a bit more humble to come up with, you know, great conclusions about, you know, whatever phenomenon I'm happen to be interested in. And there is big differences, right? So in Peru, people are, you know, in the communities that I study, people were much shyer, much more timid, much more sort of closed to community. Whereas in Kenya, you know, it's very, very open and very upbeat. So it does require adapting. But it's a very interesting challenge that I like to sort of face. And it's very rewarding, right? At the end of the day, you learn a lot of new stuff. And that's very rewarding. And I think that's part of the reason why many people aren't in this business that's called academia.
Yeah, and you're sort of a new breed of academics that is stepping outside of the what we used to call area studies or regional specialization and looking at these things in a very broad comparative framework, which I think is extraordinarily useful, and I commend you for doing that. You also said that you learn a bunch of new stuff, and the final question that I have for you here is one that I always love to ask my guests, is that looking back on your research career, and you're still pretty young in the profession, but you've had exposure to a lot of different environments, a lot of different ways of thinking about the world. Is there anything along the way that surprised you that you didn't expect to find or that maybe made you change your mind about how you actually look at the world?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think one thing that I've sort of starting to believe in, at least, is that, you know, human beings are very, very similar in many contexts. But one thing that I do always find is that there is an interesting separation, if you will, between people that are more altruistically minded and people that are not. That, you know, this may not be entirely surprising to many, but it really seems to be something in the human condition. There's some nice people and some people that are not quite as nice, at least to me or at least to others. So that just seems to be a general phenomenon, and I wonder if that's just sort of inside of us, and it doesn't really change, and it explains a bunch of outcomes, but that's just something I've been wondering about recently. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's something that's been on my mind, certainly.
Yeah, no, it answers my question just fine, because we always get different perspectives when we engage in our research. And sometimes it's not an answer that we find, it's just more questions that need to be answered. And you are definitely asking these questions, and we're going to have to keep track of what you're doing in Kenya with all the new projects that you have going on down there, and check back in with you when you get some of this stuff published. My guest today has been Anselm Rink. Anselm, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.